The views and opinions expressed on this program are not necessarily those of this station, JVC Broadcasting Management, or its sponsors.
Welcome to Crime and Justice Radio, where we talk all things crime, justice, mayhem, and the courts with expert insiders and legal outcasts. I'm your host, Aida Leisenring, and I'm here every Monday night with my co-host, Bruce Barquette.
Good evening, Aida. How are you?
Good evening. Jay Oliver this morning actually told me something I didn't even realize. Is it rare for the woman to forget the anniversary? But it is our Crime and Justice Radio six-month anniversary. We've been doing this for 6 months, once a week, every Monday night.
Remember the first thing I asked when we were on air?
No.
What are we doing here? Don't we have real work to do? Clients to represent, briefs to write, witnesses to prepare.
And yes, we do have our day jobs, and we've been hard at work. It's gotten extremely busy, even though trials are still not at their regular pace. God knows the motion writing is. So we've been filing, you know, there's been arraignment charges, new cases coming in. At least I'm heavy at work filing motions. I don't know about you, Bruce. I don't know what you're doing.
I'm doing my part.
But
it's been a fun 6 months. It really has been. Are we going to continue? Is the question.
Who knows? But I want to reflect back, not in a corny way, to say we had some unbelievable guests.
Do we really want to do this?
We do. We started off with the Republican candidate for district attorney in Suffolk County. We've had on two separate police commissioners. We've had exonerees Amanda Knox and Marty Tankliff on. We had a prison warden who literally performed executions and then had a change of heart. We had Aaron Moriarty, the amazing journalist out of 48 Hours, HBO stars and whistleblowers for the NXIVM sex trafficking cult, Bill Cosby's lawyer literally the day after Bill Cosby was released, Harvey Weinstein and Rudy Giuliani's lawyer, famous civil rights lawyer Ron Kuby, Michael Valva's attorney, John Leturco, who's our partner. We had a New York Times bestselling author and restorative justice advocate, Jennifer Thompson, Innocence Project creator and OJ lawyer, Barry Sheck, Vanessa Potkin, my co-executive producer of ABC's The Last Defense. And we actually got a call from an inmate with an innocence claim calling live from inside of the prison. And more.
All right. Well, that's a little summary. I'm always one to look ahead. And unless I have a glass of an adult beverage in front of me, I'm not often inclined to tell stories, kind of war stories.
If you can't reflect back with some kind of joy, then I would guess I was doing something wrong.
No, I know. But let's move forward. Oh, let's talk about today's show.
Today's show, we got we're going to talk Tupac, Jimmy the Henchman, and Trump, and what they all have in common. We have an amazing guest who's going to bring all those three together, Lonnie Story, who's the media fixer, the Michael Clayton of legal cases in the media, who has helped exonerate wrongfully convicted people. We'll talk press with him and strategies for Brian Laundrie, what he would do if he had them as a client.
Well, let's stop for a second. And Tupac, a famous, now, can I say dead rapper?
Well, he's dead.
He is dead. He was shot in Las Vegas.
Right. Did you think he was still alive?
No.
Is that why you were reluctant?
I'm just not sure I can say the famous dead rapper, but okay. I didn't mean any offense.
Yeah, he's gone.
Dead. He's certainly
his
dead.
His music is alive, but
and
he's not.
His alleged shooter, the person who allegedly was behind his murder, was Jimmy Roseman, who's also known as Jimmy the Henchman Roseman, who is a an individual who as we'll hear a little bit later on, was sort of pardoned by Trump. But we'll talk about that in a bit. I just wanted to put that in a little context.
His lawyers say was pardoned.
Right.
And that he's being illegally held against.
And he's still in a West Virginia prison, as far as I know.
Correct.
So that'll be an interesting conversation. And Lonnie Story is a fascinating individual just because of the clients he's had, from Marty Tankliff to Jimmy the Henchman to General Motors to
Bob Marley's estate.
Yeah, exactly. So it'll be fun to talk about how the press affects criminal justice. But before we get to that, I know you want to chat a little bit about the passing. And I say the passing, the execution of Ernest Johnson last week.
That's right. So we had our last show on Monday. On Tuesday, Ernest Johnson, who was on death row in Missouri, was executed. And I think anytime there's an execution, even though they're all too common, it's something that deserves a moment, a pause, and we should investigate the facts of the case and the legal claims made by attorneys here, a very meritorious one in my view, that he shouldn't have been executed because he was intellectually disabled. So for those who don't know, the Supreme Court back in 2002 in Atkins versus Virginia ruled 6-3 that executing people with intellectual disabilities violates the Eighth Amendment's ban on cruel and unusual punishment. But they also held that states can define who has an intellectual disability. And generally speaking, an IQ of 70 or below would meet that standard. So what do we know about Ernest Johnson? Well, according to his lawyers and other experts that examined him, he had a range of IQs from 67 to 77. His communication skills were less than those of a typical 5-year-old. He lost about 1/5 of his brain tissue when a benign tumor was removed in 2008. And understand this, the crime was brutal. It was horrible. He was put to death on Tuesday for using a hammer to kill 3 workers during a convenience store robbery in 1994. But think about that, 1994, and he was executed by lethal injection as a 61-year-old. So think about the decades he spent on death row with this intellectual disability. So it took him about 9 minutes to die. Originally, or actually from the inception, the lawyers had said if you are going to execute him, that he wished it to be carried out by firing squad, which isn't authorized by Missouri law.
And I dare say that's request is a product of his intellectual disability.
Well, but his lawyers argued that the pentobarbital, I cannot say that word, the lethal injection could trigger seizures because Johnson has epilepsy as a result of his benign tumor in his brain that was removed in 2008. So they argued that that would have been a less cruel form of execution than the potential.
I think you're right that we want to note when these individuals are executed by our country, especially somebody like this who poses no threat to anyone, who's been in prison for almost 30 years and who's intellectually disabled. But it is...
It's kind of, if you see his image and you hear his voice, you know that it's just wrong to kill him. He's certainly not the man he was when he killed those 3 individuals. He was in a drug-infused craze. He was born with fetal alcohol syndrome. And I want to read his last statement. It was written, and I think it's probably reflective of the person he was moments before he died. "I am sorry and have remorse for what I do. I want to say that I love my family and friends. I am thankful of all that my lawyer has done for me. They made me feel love as if I was family to them. I love them all. For all the people that has prayed for me, I thank them from the bottom of my," and then he didn't say heart, but I think that's what he meant. "I love the Lord with all my heart and soul. If I am executed, I know where I am going to heaven because I ask him to forgive me, God, everyone, wit, respect, Ernest Johnson," wit, spelled W-H-I-T.
You know,
and that was dated the day before his execution.
And if there's a heaven, and I certainly think there's something afterwards, he'll meet not only, you know, divine beings, he'll meet his victims, and his victims will meet him. And I recall a part of scripture, and the first martyr in Christian church was Stephen, who was stoned to death at the behest in part of St. Paul, who was initially against Christianity and was thinking it was some kind of heresy. So he actually had a hand in Stephen's demise, and Stephen was stoned to death. And there's a quote from A Man for All Seasons, which is Thomas More, the patron saint of lawyers, where he mentions that no doubt Stephen and Paul are in heaven together and are unified and have forgiven one another. Stephen has forgiven Paul. So I hope that the victims and Ernest are at this point in heaven together and have the victims have forgiven him as well. So
I'm going to rename this Crime and Justice and Bible Radio. Jesuit Bruce Barquette.
Some scripture. It's an apt observation, I think, that when we say he's going to heaven, you have to remember he's going to be greeted by the people that he murdered. And I think that's a profound thought, if you will, realization.
I agree. And I think you're going to tell us about...
Well, I want to talk a little bit about somebody who's still alive and still in prison and not facing the death penalty. And that's Kevin Strickland in Missouri. A bizarre, in my view, just an absolutely bizarre case. So Kevin Strickland was convicted in 1994 of three murders. And he has maintained his innocence all along. He's 62 years old now. He's been in prison for this entire time.
43 years.
One eyewitness who's now recanted. Two other people who participated in the murder, who actually did the shootings, have filled out affidavits and said that Mr. Strickland was not involved at all. They've served their time and they're out. The prosecutor in Jackson County...
This is the weird part.
The prosecutor in Jackson County has reviewed the case through their conviction integrity unit and has concluded that he is innocent.
So case over. You should get out, right?
And so they were looking for a way to get this before the courts, and there was no way in Missouri. And we talked about this several months ago. Aaron Moriarty featured it on 48 Hours, and there was no way for him to get out. And so he was in jail despite the fact that his attorneys and the prosecutor both concluded that he's innocent and he doesn't belong in prison. Well, Missouri's legislature took care of that. They established enacted a new law that allows for a hearing for individuals like this where you can go to court and prove by clear and convincing evidence that you're actually innocent. Great. So the prosecutor, who's in charge of the criminal prosecutions in Jackson County, and Mr. Strickland's lawyers are going to go and into court and move to have his conviction vacated, and he should get out.
And by the way, just so people know, this is once the conviction integrity unit in the district attorney's office has agreed that your client is innocent, then you do a joint application in front of a judge and the judge exonerates him and releases him. There's usually zero tension
pushback. Right. The judge has an independent role to review the evidence, but generally speaking, these things are not done frivolously. District attorney's offices don't agree to release somebody who's been in prison for 43 years unless there's a good reason to do so. But here, he's not getting out. In fact, the attorney general in Missouri has stepped in and has insisted that Mr. Strickland is guilty, and have now the attorney general's office is fighting to keep him in, and is fighting. One observer said it's state versus state. It's the state of Missouri versus the state of Missouri. You have the prosecutor's office fighting with the attorney general's office.
That's so 2021, where things are just absurd and backwards.
It truly is. He has a hearing set for November 8th, I believe. The attorney general's office not only stepped in here to fight his exoneration, successfully moved to disqualify 16 judges in Jackson County, arguing that they're all biased. The Supreme Court of Missouri agreed. A new judge was appointed.
They didn't agree they were biased. They agreed that it could have the appearance of bias because maybe they've made comments supporting that his case should be overturned. I don't know the specifics of what they've said or done.
Well, they disqualified the judges. And in addition to that, they fought to conduct a new investigation, to look at new evidence, to look at more forensic examinations, and actually argue that the hearing shouldn't go forward at all. They've lost most of those arguments. The hearing is going to go forward, and we'll see what happens. One of the saddest parts of this story is Mr. Jackson's now in a wheelchair. He can't stand for very long. I said Mr. Jackson. It's Mr. Strickland. He's now in a wheelchair. He can't stand for very long. And he had expressed in an interview he did early this summer that he wanted to get out to see his mother before his mother died. His mother died in August, and he was not allowed to go to her funeral. Aaron Moriarty, in an interview, asked him, "Would you like to get your life back?" And his response was, "What life? What life? I just want to have a life. I've been in prison for 43 years since I was 19 years old. The only memory I have is prison." One would think that if the state of Missouri has already let out the people who actually conducted the shootings, actually perpetrated the murders, that Mr. Jackson's 43 years would be enough, even if you thought he was guilty. And again, the prosecutor shouldn't. The DA's office does not think he's guilty.
It's heartbreaking. And just as just brief background, the only evidence against him at all, there was no forensic evidence, there was no video surveillance, there was nothing tying him to the crime, was a single eyewitness who claims police told her, just pick Strickland out of the lineup and we'll be done. It will all go away. You can go on and you don't have to worry about these guys anymore. And she made multiple attempts to retract that statement, confessing that Strickland was not the person that she saw at the crime scene. And as you said, the two co-defendants who actually did participate in the murders have confessed, have pled guilty, have served their time, and have filled that affidavit saying he had nothing to do with it.
I mean, there's some things about our criminal justice system that I find very, very frustrating. And one of them is the just absolute blindness of prosecutors who insist that individuals who, for which there is an overwhelming amount of evidence of actual innocence, that they're still guilty. And they fight this as if we're taking something from them, as if there's nobody. And we actually know a former prosecutor who thinks that almost nobody is convicted who is innocent. Yes, we do. I won't name that individual.
After Crime and Justice Radio
but
is over.
We do indeed. And it just is a mind-boggling thing to think that if we arrest people on probable cause with a human system, that the system does not make unbelievable errors. And you and I know people who have been wrongly convicted. Marty Tankliff, one of our paralegals, Sam Brownridge, who is a client of
Don
ours.
Don Taylor, Al Newton.
Right.
Barry Gibbs, who passed away.
Right. A number of these individuals. So we're going to follow this story, and we'll see what happens to Mr. Strickland in November. I want to touch on, if we can, because this is... Well, we'll see. Hopefully we'll follow it. We'll see if we're still around. We'll follow it one way or the other. I want to talk real quick about Justice...
Oh, allow
Jenny
me,
Go
allow
ahead.
Me
Go
the,
ahead.
The
Go
honor.
Ahead.
So
we're going to shift gears
to all those who say the face of the unvaccinated are these Southern couth, uneducated, Trump-supporting morons. A big shock hit New York State when Judge Jenny Rivera, who was appointed by Cuomo in 2013 to the highest court in New York State, the Court of Appeals, refused to disclose her vaccination status.
And it's presumed that she has not been vaccinated.
She didn't ask for a medical exemption, or we don't know what she did or didn't ask for.
But she didn't ask for any exemptions from the reporting that exists. And people should know that Jenny Rivera is reputed to be one of the more liberal judges on the Court of Appeals in New York. So she is in opposite of the profile.
Right. Her whole professional career was in public service. She clerked for Justice Sotomayor of the Supreme Court. She worked at the Legal Aid Society. She was a civil rights practitioner. She was at the Puerto Rican Defense Fund. So her whole life has been for public service.
And she's apparently politely declined the vaccination and is hearing oral arguments remotely, hasn't been in her chambers in the Court of Appeals.
Right. She's barred from entering any court facilities, including her own chambers. And I think the claim is that she's the only state judge out of a total of approximately 1,300 who politely declined, which reminds me of my high school reading, Bartleby the Scrivener.
Oh.
I love it. He would politely decline by saying, "I prefer not to."
There's a story that goes with that we can't tell right now, but it's okay.
I always kind of root for an underdog. La Resistance to her. And listen, she brave? She can't get fired.
Well,
she's not a nurse subjected to getting fired. She's not a pilot to getting fired and so forth.
There's two nurses that I know that have both been fired recently for refusing a vaccine, one on religious grounds, one for another reason. And these are individuals that have treated COVID patients for the last 20 months or so, and they've lost their jobs because they've declined these mandates. Again, we don't take positions on whether or not you should get vaccinated or not, but these mandates to me seem to be a little bit over the top, and I'll be curious to see if it reaches the Court of Appeals what Justice Rivera or Judge Rivera will do with the case if she gets it, if she's even going to recuse herself.
I can't imagine it won't go to the Court of Appeals at some point.
Let's see. We'll be back in a minute with Lonnie Sori, who'll talk about the
fixer.
Press.
Welcome back to Crime and Justice Radio. I'm Aida Leisenring, and I'm here with co-host Bruce Barquette. And it's my greatest honor to introduce our fantastic guest, Lonnie Sori. Let me tell you a little about Lonnie Sori. He's an expert in crisis communications and the nexus of the law and the media. So I think of Michael Clayton. Remember that movie?
Oh, I love that movie.
He was the fixer. So Lonnie Sori is like the fixer of high-profile legal cases. He's represented companies such as General Motors on race discrimination matters, the estates of Bob Marley and J.R.R. Tolkien on intellectual property, University of Cincinnati after campus police killed an unarmed and innocent African-American man, the U.S. Virgin Islands, government in the aftermath of two Category 5 hurricanes, and led the public campaign to free Marty Tankleff in Long Island and Damian Echols on death row in the West Memphis 3 case in Arkansas. He's the co-founder of Families and Friends of the Wrongfully Convicted, and he's still at work, and he's going to talk to us about his latest exciting high-profile clients. Welcome, Lonnie.
Hey, thanks a lot. You know, it's very interesting, but when you talk about the influence of the media in legal cases, I got a bone to pick with you guys. My client, Jimmy Rosemond, was never involved in the killing or even allegations of Tupac Shakur.
Oh, he is reputed to
reputed
have been involved.
To. Did you say that, Bruce, or did you jump? I didn't say he was.
I absolutely said that, and he absolutely is reputed to be behind the murder of Tupac, although he was never charged with that.
No, he's reputed to be behind a shooting of Tupac in New York that happened years before.
There you go. Lonnie's doing his job.
There we go. He's protecting James Roseman. I don't want to say anything bad about the henchmen, that's for sure.
But tell us about that.
You walked right into it. Talk about the work you're doing for Mr. Roseman now.
Okay. Now, what's happened is he was convicted and sentenced to 9 life terms in prison. He served 10 years, and this was for an alleged murder that was, he had 3 trials. One was overturned on by the Second Circuit, and then he was retried and convicted a third time. And some very important people who are friends of his, including Jim Brown and Michael K. Williams, the actor who just passed away, Derek Hamilton, who's an exoneree, and a whole group of people have been working for years to look at...
Like Wyclef Jean, like some major folks.
Yeah, yeah. And, the letters that he has from friends and family are incredible. He's an incredible guy. He's imperfect, but does not deserve to be in prison the number of years that he got, and he has already served 10 years. What happened was Jim Brown, the infamous meeting of Kanye West at the White House, which many of us saw on television, sitting along Kanye was Jim Brown, the famous football player, and an attorney that he had brought all along to look at James Rosemond's case. So when this thing with Kanye was going on, Jim Brown hands Trump a 2-page description of this case and asks him to take a look at it. Now, that's 2018. They work for 2 years with Jared Kushner, the White House counsel, supplying tremendous amount of new information over the next 2 years. And on Christmas, right a few days before Christmas, as Trump is about to leave office, he calls Jim Brown up and says, "We're getting your guy out." And in fact, they were later called and said, "Go down to Virginia and pick him up at the prison." So the family goes down. Jim Brown, you know, everybody's thrilled. It's really an unbelievable turn of events. And when they go down to the West Virginia federal prison, nobody lets them out. Now, the attorneys have filed a habeas corpus, and they found some very unique, interesting history and precedent where they believe, and so do some of the experts in the field, that the president does not have to give a written order. A verbal order of a commutation counts as strongly as a written order. They don't have to be written. In fact, it goes back to President Lincoln, who commuted sentences of soldiers who either deserted or about to be executed.
So did Trump give a verbal order?
Trump called up Jim Brown and said, "We're getting your guy out of prison."
And didn't Jared Kushner also indicate the same to Roseman's attorneys?
Yeah, Jared called up the attorneys and said, "Go pick up your guy." Yes.
So this was
clear.
And then this, okay. You've just filed, or not you, but the attorneys have just filed an action in federal court, seeking his release. What's been the Department of Justice reaction to this?
They haven't reacted to it. We have heard nothing from the Department of Justice. We actually are petitioning now President Biden to act on this, and they're, you know, we haven't had any. It was just filed just a few days ago.
Oh, interesting. Now,
has anyone tried to reach out to Trump or Jared Kushner?
Yeah, they did. And the media.
Like, remember that time when you said?
What do you know? Gus Garcia.
Oh yes.
Oh yeah. He's a Long Island guy.
Gus Garcia Roberts, yeah. And that's when I got this case, when I got a call from Jim Rosemont from prison. He called me, and I just said, "Well, this is the Washington Post." I mean, and I thought, you know, listen, let me try. And I called Gus. He works at the Washington Post. And I tell him, "Listen, I got a really interesting story, but it's completely confidential. This is before the filing." And of course, lawyers would including Bruce Barquette, because I used to constantly get stuff to the press before Bruce filed it. In the Marty Tankleff case, I admit now.
It's confessions. I told you this was Bible radio.
And that started a whole process of Gus looking at the case, talking to lawyers, talking to other people. Obviously, we have petitions from affidavits from Jim Brown. Jim Brown's wife was also called, and others that that heard the president declare that he would be home for Christmas.
So it's a fascinating case. I can't wait to see how it turns out. Yep. And if it turns out well, maybe you can get Mr. Roseman to come on the show with us. You can
absolutely
bring him on, and we'll all chat together.
We won't ask him about Tupac.
No, I will not ask.
You know, it's interesting. We're talking about essentially what we're talking about is the court of public opinion, right? I have to say that, and this brilliant attorney may not remember this, but when I asked him one day how a case we were working on was going, he stuck his finger, he licked his finger and held it in the air, and said, "It depends which way the wind is blowing." I'll never forget that. And that was Bruce. You may not remember this.
I thought you said he was a brilliant lawyer.
And because what you were essentially saying was, the court of public opinion.
Well, this is why we have you on. We want to get into this whole idea of the media and the courts and the use of the media and responding to it and how lawyers react and the role of a public relations person in a criminal defense team or on a criminal defense team.
Is no comment ever prudent?
Yeah. What I would say is the court of public opinion has driven prosecutions of high-profile criminal and civil litigation since the beginning of our American legal system. If you go back 300 years to the Salem witch trials, that was driven by what? Coven Mather and the community created based on a fact of witches or witchcraft, and that became the narrative. And in every criminal prosecution, certainly high profile. Those are the ones we learn about. The prosecution creates a narrative that is then given to the public and the press. And the defense, often because of lack of experience of the attorneys, because of fear of the attorneys and the family, they don't want to piss off the judge, they don't want to do this, and they don't, and essentially just get their asses kicked in the public arena. And when it's public, that not only impacts the jury pool, but it impacts the judge, him or herself, because they are elected officials. Our judges, certainly in New York State, are elected officials, and in probably 25% of the 25 states around the country. So you were dealing in politics. Damien Echols on death row. He gets out. And that was a long, long effort involving a lot of famous people who didn't speak to the public. I came on the case, and I started driving the issues that were innocence. So essentially what we are is speaking innocence to the public. So what we try to do is change the narrative, right? Now, unfortunately, most times I'm called on cases is what we say after somebody's wrongfully convicted, which means 10 or 20 or 30 years after they've been in prison. I'm rarely called on a case when it starts. Had I been in Marty Tancliffe's case when it starts, had the defense lawyers asked my advice, we would have had a different narrative out there. We would have the narrative of the evidence of Marty's innocence.
At least the competing narrative.
Exactly.
And for people who, this kind of highfalutin lawyers, oh, we don't try the case in the press, I'll deal with it in the courtroom.
Right.
It's right. You're laughing because it's utter nonsense. Because if you allow the prosecution to drive the narrative, as you put it, or to form public opinion, by the time you get to trial, you're dead in the water.
So let me ask you this, because you say you get involved often after decades of bad publicity and wrongful right. conviction, and you have to turn the tables. Now, we have Brian Laundrie in the news every single day. Everyone thinks he murdered Ms. Petito, despite no murder charges against him. Everyone thinks there was a history of domestic violence, and everyone has vilified his family and thinks they are hiding where he is and the information that he possibly disclosed to them. How in the world do you Michael Clayton this case?
Well, I do choose the cases I work on.
Yes.
I would not choose necessarily work on that case, but there's some really interesting aspects of it. Because when you think of, obviously, both of those kids.
You know what's funny? Let me stop you for 1 second. You say you wouldn't pick this case, you wouldn't choose this case. That's because you've bought the narrative that's been sold so far. If you'd bought the narrative of Marty Tancliffe or Echols or half a dozen other people that you've represented over the years, you wouldn't have gotten involved in the case. So just
touché.
Just to
touché,
say
you're
that,
right.
Right.
I mean, very good point. I mean, I don't. I choose the cases I work on.
Right.
But it's interesting. I was contacted by a guy who was a billionaire. A computer expert who was 50 years old, had built a $1 billion company, and his private equity investors wanted him out, and they leaked to the media that when he was 17 years old, he's 49 now, he had been involved with skinheads, and they had shot a temple. They had shot a window in a temple. My first reaction and the reaction of people that my family was, don't get involved in this case. And my first reaction was, let me hear what he has to say.
There you go.
And it was an incredible, and I represented him because it was this honest guy who was mortified by his history. So you're right.
So what do you do with Laundrie? What do you do with Laundrie?
Well, it's very interesting. If you look, not only are we talking about innocence issues, but we're talking about mitigating circumstances. Because in many, many cases, even if somebody was involved in a murder, sometimes there are circumstances that the public needs to know that whether somebody was, psychologically troubled, whether it was an accident, whether, those things. In this case, it's very interesting. You have two people who are both clearly troubled, psychologically troubled. I don't know if she was an abuse victim. It certainly looks like it there. But we don't know what happened. Had that, it could be not. It could have been that they had a physical fight, that she hit her head, that he, we don't know what happened. Let's find out, right? If I knew what happened, then that would be important information to get out. Because, in fact, had he stayed with her, and let's say he did you know, there were mitigating circumstances, he probably would be charged with manslaughter and not second-degree murder.
Right. And let's stop for a second and again and say, whatever happened here, one thing that we can say is the family, with all due respect to the people that are trying to help them, are being ill-served by the advice that they're getting, if they're getting any advice, about how to deal with the media and how to deal with this case. And that's unfortunate because it's an area, like it or not, public relations and the press is an area that you have to have some expertise in. You need somebody. We represent people in crimes all the time. We don't pretend we know a lot about medical examiners. We hire a medical examiner. We know a lot about forensics and firearms and fingerprints and DNA. Each of those areas require a separate expert with us consulting with them to decide how we're going to deal with the evidence. In the same way, when we, our firm, get high-profile cases, we don't go wandering off into the forest of public relations without some help. We try to get an expert. We try to get somebody to come in and say, hey, what can we do here? And, you know, we worked together on Marty Tankleff's case. We also worked together, you may recall, on Cal Harris's case.
I was going to mention Cal Harris.
Right? Where there's a guy who absolutely spent years in prison because of the bad press he got in the county where he was.
And it's interesting, an exoneree named Derek Hamilton, who I helped get out of prison, was a guy who recommended you to Cal Harris and a private detective.
And what
right
was
now,
interesting,
any attorney who does not recognize that prosecutions are driven by public factors, any attorney who's not prepared to deal with them and does not have a public strategy to combat them is committing malpractice.
And Cal Harris was a perfect example of that. He was, you know, he had national media attention, even though it was a small town in upstate New York. His beautiful wife went missing. They were in the middle of a divorce. They had four children, and he was this vilified, wealthy, used car sales, you know, business owner. And half the town hated him. He had a type A personality, and he didn't physically look good, you know, in terms of empathy. And trial one and trial two both resulted in prompt, quick, within hours, convictions. And there was no positive or favorable press on him whatsoever. Bruce and I, the whole firm got involved. You got involved. And the kids are older. Guess what? We're going to show you who Cal Harris is. He's a father. He's continued to raise his kids, even while he was in prison. He's someone who wants information about who's responsible for this. And you did a fantastic job. Ultimately, we got an acquittal in that case.
And
that's why when we had the news conference, we went up there and we, you know, had posters of his statements. We had his kids there. They interviewed. It was crucially important. The guy was an unpleasant.
Some people
he's a
say
little
this,
rough around the edges,
some people say the same thing about me. I like Cal a lot, and I recognize that he is, Aida said, a type A personality. He's a good guy. He raised four kids under horrific circumstances, being pursued by the state police and the DA's office up there for 15 years.
I want to
jump ahead to. Sorry, you were going to say something?
Yeah, no, I want to talk about Pamela Smart because that's brilliant. But real quick, if you don't mind, in 30 seconds or less, how do you feel about using kids generally in a parent's cause? Because that can be a tricky thing.
Well, listen, what I look for is what's the truth? Where's the innocence? What's the evidence? And as I once said, I'd interview the devil. I'd have the devil himself interviewed if it was in my client's interest. If I can get information out there that the public doesn't have, I'm talking about credible information, facts about the case, I will use anybody and anything to do that because it's so hard. The media often is so determined against it because they are being fed one thing. The narrative is the key. Every prosecution, the narrative in Marty Tankleff's case was that he was a spoiled rich kid. They had three girls testify that Marty said he would, if his parents weren't around, he'd be rich. I don't know if his lawyer knew, but the estate said Marty couldn't get money for 10 more years. That whether it was the capturing in Friedman's case in in Great Neck, a massive sexual abuse case. The courts have now said that there's been no mass sexual abuse cases in 70 cases. Damien Eccles was the great satanic cult killing of three little children, and the prosecution brought in a satanic expert. It was the most absurd
phony. We had Pamela Smart, who I understand the trial itself was the first trial covered gavel to gavel on United States television. Tell us about her case and
Pamela
what you're doing.
Pamela Smart has been sitting in New York State Prison, interestingly, it's a New Hampshire case, for 31 years. She's the longest serving woman prisoner in New York. She was a 22-year-old kid who worked in a school. She wasn't a teacher. She was immature, naive, got involved with some rough kids. She was having an affair. The kids went out, who had a long history of crime, and killed her husband. She recognizes now that there were things that she probably could have done to stop it. She was convicted of conspiracy, of murder. She was sentenced to life without parole. There was no evidence that she did anything in terms of giving this kid money or a gun or whatever. It's a tragic case. Again, she accepts her responsibility for creating an atmosphere where these kids felt that they could go do that. But this woman needs to get a commutation. She needs New Hampshire to look at it and commute her sentence, because she was sentenced to life without parole. The four kids that were involved in the murder are all free.
Hey, Lonnie, I want to thank you for coming on. Believe it or not, we're basically out of time. It goes quickly.
Thank you for all the good work you're doing, especially on
Keep
behalf of those wrongfully convicted.
And when James and Pamela get out, we'll want to have them back. Thanks.
Okay, great. Keep going. This is a great show. Thanks, Ryan.
Thank you.
Thank you.
On that note, I want to just say that, we don't do ratings on this show. We don't measure how many people listen or don't listen. But if you like the show, do us a small favor. We're literally making a decision whether or not we can continue to do it. Right now, we're continuing to do it. But if you like the show, let the station know that you like the show. Give them a call, shoot an email or a note or something to say, we like Crime and Justice Radio and we want it to continue. And we'll be back next week with another show of Crime and Justice Radio.
And here's a little shout out to Mike Casale, our amazing producer.
Unbelievable. Good stuff.
Thank you.
The views and opinions expressed on this program are not necessarily those of this station, JVC Broadcasting Management, or its sponsors.